Mark Brewer as former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. Jeff Timmer as former executive director of the Michigan Republicans. And this is a Republic, if you can keep it, with Mark Brewer and Jeff Timmer.
Welcome to A Republic, if you can keep it. I'm Jeff Timmer. Later in the podcast, Mark Brewer and I will be joined by Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. But first up, the politics of the week. And the news this week was pretty bizarre, a whole lot going on. Mark, let's start with the lawsuit that was filed in federal court challenging Michigan's new congressional districts drawn by the Citizens Redistricting Commission, a suit filed by several Republicans.
Yeah, Jeff. So this is the latest litigation that's now pending over the maps. Pending before the Michigan Supreme Court is the case about the Voting Rights Act, which affects all three maps. This case was filed, within the last 24 hours, as you and I talk, by Republican activists, including a current state rep and former state rep, in federal court, claiming that the congressional map violates the federal constitution in terms of how its lines were drawn. But I think this is really just a pretext to try to get a different map drawn. They attached to their complaint a different map, which is clearly a Republican gerrymander. It makes dramatic changes in the existing map. So this, again, looks like an effort just to get a federal court to engage in gerrymandering and tilt the map even more toward the Republicans than the existing one. Under longstanding United States Supreme Court precedent, this case belongs in the Michigan Supreme Court. The state constitution is very clear that that court can hear federal claims, just like it's hearing the Voting Rights Act claim, and that's where it belongs. But currently, the Republicans here are forum shopping. They are looking for friendly Republican-appointed judges who they hope will rule in their favor and then redraw the map in their favor as well. And I hope that the lawyers for the commission will do the right thing and promptly tell that federal court, as the Supreme Court would tell them, this belongs in the Michigan Supreme Court, not in federal court. So we'll see how that all plays out, but the partisan mischief continues.
Well, for our listeners out there, this is not just some backbenchers in the Michigan legislature who are plaintiffs in this case. There's a long list of connected Republicans who are plaintiffs, but more telling to me are the attorneys who've brought the lawsuit. These are attorneys in Washington who operate at the highest level of Republican politics, of inside Republican politics, of Federalist Society Republican politics. And this shows the fact that they're involved, that this is a very coordinated and sanctioned effort by national Republicans to overturn what the voters in Michigan selected in 2018 was a maps not drawn by politicians. You can rest assured that the maps that are attached to their complaint were drawn by partisans with nothing but partisan aims.
Yes, these lawyers, Jeff, were among the lawyers that we opposed in the federal gerrymandering trial a couple of years ago. Again, defending Republican Party interests there. So yeah, I have no doubt these kinds of lawyers, these type of lawyers, don't bring these kind of lawsuits without a sign off from the highest levels of the Republican Party nationally and in Michigan. Even though, again, the plaintiffs are a group of Republican activists and office holders, there are bigger forces at work here in terms of the agenda.
We've also had a lot of movement that's somewhat behind the scenes with regard to ballot initiatives that are looming here in Michigan. There was a very raucous and long meeting with the State Board of Canvassers, that august body that I used to serve on, that rules on a very often obscure, at least as far as the public knows, things coordinated or associated with ballot initiatives, the wording of ballot initiatives, the approving of petitions to be circulated to get issues onto the ballot before the voters of Michigan. You had quite a busy day, having been involved in or being involved in three of the cases, I think all three that were before the commission. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a very long day from the board of canvassers. You know, Jeff, and you know this, that used to be a sleepy board, right? really obscure, et cetera. Starting in the 90s, that whole process of the board, not just the petition drives, but as we saw in 2020, its role in certifying elections, right? There was a lot of drama, a lot of uncertainty. So that board was going to certify the 2020 elections, and ultimately one of the members, a Republican, voted no to certify. Now, this board has now become highly politicized, and that's been exacerbated by the fact that these ballot proposals are increasingly popular. By my count, there are over a dozen ballot proposals circulating, pending before the board, or even potential, as we sit here in mid-January. And the fights over the petition summary, over the language that goes on the ballot, are challenges to signatures, have just, you know, blossomed, exploded, particularly in the last several years. I think what we also see is because the legislature and the governor can often be gridlocked on issues, increasingly people see going to the ballot, whether it's voting rights, yay or nay. You know, we've seen two of the voter suppression proposals pass through that board, including one on Wednesday. This idea that we're now going to put up a partisan audit board and it's going to audit the 2020 elections, you know, Trump's dream, et cetera. To voting rights, reproductive choice, it's the environmental issues, all the things that, you know, government can get gridlocked about between the governor and the legislature come before this board. So that heightens the stakes before this board. And, you know, again, it was it's the longest meeting I've ever attended. I've been practicing before that board for decades. We were there for 6 hours going over summaries for petitions. That's how contentious this whole process has come. And I hope that voters will pay more and more attention to this. We had a good crowd there on Wednesday, and there was some press in attendance because, again, this is really crystallizes a lot of the very controversial issues that the body politic here in Michigan has to decide.
Well, I think this is looming, setting up to be a tremendous election year with not just some very important partisan races on the ballot that a lot of people will pay attention to, but there will be a number of these petitions out there are likely to end up being on the ballot. They have the wherewithal, they have the resources, they have the infrastructure to get these issues onto the ballot. And there will be some a ton of money spent for and against some of these proposals. There will be a lot of public attention, and a lot of this will be decided on the, you know, kind of partisan positions. And so the top of the ticket will in how people turn out for, you know, to vote for governor will have impact on the ability of these proposals to win or lose ultimately. And so they don't get a lot of attention, and they don't get a lot of the focus, but they are very important. And there are some very key policy decisions that will be before the voters on some very what have become emotional issues, like counting votes. No one thought that was going to be an emotional issue, you know, a year ago, but now it is. Two issues that have been emotional for a long time, like abortion rights and restricting or not restricting abortion rights. And so there's going to be a lot of passions in this election, which often aren't around for a midterm non-presidential election.
That's right. I think some of these, Jeff, because of our unique provision that the legislature can adopt these proposals and the governor can't veto them, could become issues in Republican primaries. I mean, there are two voucher proposals. There's this alleged audit proposal I talked about. There's a voter suppression proposal out there. And I think the hope of those sponsors is not to get to the ballot in the fall. They want the Republican legislature to adopt them and bypass the governor. And that's going to put Republican legislators in a difficult spot. You know, they could be primaried based on the fact that they voted for or against some of these proposals. So this is not something that even the legislature is going to be able to dodge and put off until the fall. But let me turn the tables and ask you about a big development this week. We see the further unfolding of what apparently was a national conspiracy to seat alternative electors, not only from Michigan, but elsewhere. And it's starting to come out through the January 6th investigative committee. What's your take on that, Jeff?
What we've seen through these series of stories over the last week, most notably caught on tape and run on CNN in the last 24 hours, is the co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party admitting right out loud on tape that they were asked by the Trump White House and the Trump campaign to submit these fraudulent forged documents into the kind of the national chain of records, to the National Archives, send to the appropriate state officials, state and federal officials that would legally receive the official documents. You as a member of the bar perhaps needs to be a little more careful than I do, alleged wrongdoing. These are crimes. There's no doubt that what they did is crime. It is a crime. I guess when we get into intent and who's responsible is what's going to, you know, be the interesting part here. I don't think that too many people are interested in the 80-year-old hapless, you know, party activist from Charlevoix who was asked to sign this document. It's more who asked him to sign it and why and how that conspiracy played out across these states. This is a great opportunity for federal prosecutors to elicit that information, because the 80-year-old party volunteer who maybe unwittingly signed this document, not knowing that he was committing a serious federal felony, election fraud, who instructed him? How were those instructions conveyed, and who's behind those instructions? That's what's going to blow this wide open. And the more we find out about this, this was not just some spontaneous plot that was hatched from the, you know, fevered dysfunctional mind of Donald Trump and his blathering on Twitter a year ago. This was a well-planned plot to overthrow the United States government and keep in power the party, the president, who had clearly lost the election despite the very obvious and legal outcome of that election. The fact that they lacked the ability to pull it off ultimately does not in any way diminish their intent. And that's where this is ultimately going to be the undoing of Donald Trump and the Republican conspirators across the party, including people who lead the party, who serve in high political office, who serve in state offices across the country, who serve in party offices across the country, who were engaged in this conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy to overthrow the United States government.
Yeah, it was clear all this is linked to what they wanted Pence to do, right? Pence could say, oh, there are alternative slates of electors. We have a dispute. We can't count the votes here today. And we have to go to an alternative mechanism, let the congressional members vote, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yes, I think you can see now it's like a jigsaw puzzle that the pieces are being filled in and they all point in one direction. But there was a national plan here orchestrated at the highest levels, passed on through party officials like Michon Madoc, who is now a co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party, to undermine that election. This wasn't just, I think all of us remember, on January 6th, we had a group of Republican, I termed them protesters at the time, they said they were the alternative electors, who tried to get into the Capitol. I thought to myself, well, maybe they're exercising their First Amendment rights, right? It's kind of a symbolic thing. No, we're now seeing that was part of, as you said, of a national plan to undermine the election, submit alternative electors, and try to turn this thing around.
Yeah, and it doesn't make it any less of a crime because you did it willingly in front of cameras, like those fools did. I thank goodness, that these people, they had the right to remain silent. They're too stupid to ever recognize that. And thank goodness they were also too stupid and too disordered in their minds to actually pull this off, because the infrastructure was put in place and they were ready to pull the triggers that would have caused a lot of dominoes to fall. Everything from Donald Trump using ordering the military to seize vote counting machines across the country in these states. There was a clear and deliberate plot that history will look back on is maybe the darkest time ever in the history of the United States government.
Yep. And as you and I have talked about with many of our guests, it's not over. There are going to be repeated attempts to do this and pull it off in 2022 and 2024.
The discussion turns to election fraud and more, as we're joined by Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson after these messages on A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
We're honored to be joined on the podcast this week by Michigan's 43rd Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson. She is a former dean of the Wayne State University Law School in Detroit, a co-founder of the Military Spouses of Michigan, and a board member of the Ross Initiative in Sports for Equality. She's also the author of State Secretaries of State, Guardians of the Democratic Process. She is considered one of the nation's leading experts in election law. She was elected as Michigan's Secretary of State in 2018, becoming the first Democrat to hold that office since Richard Austin left it 24 years earlier.
Secretary Benson graduated magna cum laude from Wellesley College, where she founded the now annual Women in American Political Activism Conference and was the first student to be elected to serve in the governing body for the town of Wellesley, Massachusetts. Benson received her JD from Harvard Law School, where she was general editor of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. She is much, much smarter than I am. Prior to attending law school, Benson worked for the Southern Poverty Law Center as an investigative journalist, researching white supremacists and neo-Nazi organizations. Benson has also worked as a summer associate for voting rights and election law for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and as a legal assistant to Nina Totenberg at National Public Radio.
Welcome, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. Thank you so much for being with us and with your crazy busy schedule. Let's dive right in. I'm going to ask you a question that you probably didn't expect. You've been doing a lot of work that hasn't gotten a lot of publicity about service improvements in the Secretary of State offices around the state. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, thanks. It's it's one of the best things about this office. We interact with more residents than any other office almost in the state. And so it's a great opportunity to really demonstrate that government can work for citizens. It can meet people where they are and deliver efficient, convenient, responsive services to everyone. And so one of the things I did immediately upon taking office was set out to both understand and gather data of exactly how much the decades of neglect have really impacted customer service. And I visited every one of our 130 branch offices in my first 100 days, took notes about what to improve at the granular and the macro level, and realized that a lot of people were coming into branches that didn't have to. And so we wanted to modernize and make sure people knew that if you wanted to renew your license, you didn't have to come into the office, and create more ways for them to interact with our office without a trip to the branches. And then secondly, making sure that if people did go to our branch offices, that they had a good, smooth experience. And there were a lot of inefficiencies that we noticed right off the bat. And we went to work modernizing everything. And now, when I took office, 60% of our services were delivered in branches. And now we've flipped that. So Now 60% of our interactions are done online or at self-service stations and grocery stores, meaning for the remaining 40% of people who interact with our office, who go to our branches, they have a much smoother experience. By scheduling your visit ahead of time, you can let us know when you're coming so that we're ready for you when you get there. And then we also have the ability for people to simply just walk up to our office and be seen either right away or be given a time to return it within the 24 hours, the next 24 hours, so that they can then have their services as well without having to wait in lines. So in under 3 years, we've eliminated the wait times in the branches. We've streamlined our services, both in person and online, and we've put more opportunities than ever for citizens to do their business with the state without having to even leave their home. And that all collectively has created a much more efficient customer service experience for all of our citizens and really has put Michigan now truly at the forefront of delivering driver and vehicle services to citizens. We've become in many ways a model state for the rest of the country, with other states and the federal government reaching out to us to find out how we did it and what they can do to replicate our success.
That's great. I can tell from personal experience, my 90-year-old father, who is not comfortable online, I took him to a branch office, got to the front of the line because of his disability, his age, and so forth. We were in and out of there in 10 minutes. It was terrific, Jocelyn. That's a tremendous improvement that I personally experienced.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you had a good experience. And yeah, a lot of the big changes that we made were internal. And one of the biggest was just data collection. I get a report every Monday from our branch staff of how many people are walking up, making sure everyone's served right away, making sure that, you know, the appointment system is accessible for everyone. And by tracking that data, we're also able to course correct when we need to and find out where to shift resources. And the biggest ongoing thing, we have sort of two initiatives that we're launching to further improve services. The biggest is hiring. There were, you know, close to 100 vacancies when we first began, you know, hiring a few years ago at a greater pace. And we've now cut those vacancies in half. But a lot of the reason for inefficiency was simply just vacant positions that were not being filled. So we've streamlined that. And then the second thing we're going to be doing is launching mobile offices, going to senior centers once a month. I want every senior center in the state to know that on this day every month, a mobile Secretary of State branch office will be there to serve them directly, so that we have that manifestation more of bringing services to where people already are, community centers, libraries, places of worship, senior centers, homeless shelters, just the other ways that we can make it even more accessible and easy for people to access their services with the state.
That sounds great. Are the number of kiosks going to continue to grow as well around the state?
Yeah. You know, the kiosks are a great private-public partnership with a new company that we actually had folks go to Indiana because we heard great things about their services. And we found that the previous kiosks that were in place before I took office, when I visited every one of them, about a third, two-thirds were broken at any given time. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But essentially, we shifted companies to a new partnership that enables us to fix machines right away when they break down, because they send a signal to the company and they send maintenance right away and it gets fixed within a few hours. And then secondly, it enables us to easily install new machines wherever the public needs them. So Flint is one example. I went and visited our Flint offices, saw the need for a self-service machine, another self-service machine in that area, and we're able to call the company and get one out there because the company incurs all the costs and services and maintenance responsibilities for the machines. We simply just tell them where to go under the partnership. So we'll continue to expand them. We've got 150 in place throughout the state. And as their customer need increases and demand increases, we're able to quickly respond to that and, you know, put more in grocery stores and other places around the state.
Well, Mark and Jocelyn, that's all the time we have for today.
I'm a gross former professor.
Well, I want to slide over to talk a little bit about protecting democracy. I guess what comes to the forefront of my mind is the Republicans have a right to remain silent, but they're too freaking stupid to do that, which is going to be, I think, the benefit to us all. The story that was out yesterday and in the news today, the co-chair of the Michigan Republican Party saying on tape, the White House and the Trump campaign directed her and others to sign these fraudulent elector forms. Like you, maybe to just talk a little bit about that and the greater effort to protect democracy from what is clearly becoming known, or what's the evidence is showing, is a plan to subvert the last election.
Yeah, thanks. And I think it's important to note that, you know, what has recently emerged through the early investigation of the January 6th committee was this fake elector scheme, which we were aware of and referred to the attorney general back in December and January of 2020. But that was just one piece of a much broader coordinated, nationally coordinated political strategy to block the will of the people in 2020 from coming to fruition. And of course, it culminated in the tragedy in our U.S. Capitol on January 6th. But there were so many pieces, really, from the closure of the polls in November of 2020 until the inauguration in January. In that period, so many things were attempted, to all of which were unsuccessful, but many of which have been revealed, and some of them will be revealed through the ongoing investigations. The bottom line is, if there's no accountability for the multiple nefarious attempts, the fake electors included, to nullify the votes of millions of Americans and block the full results of the presidential election from coming to effect, if there's no accountability, if there are no consequences for those actions, then we must expect for them not just to repeat themselves again in 24 and beyond, but to, when they come back or reemerge, be more sophisticated and perhaps more effective than they were in 20, and for there to be people in place in 24 in the future who will be more receptive to accepting fake elector documents, or perhaps not dismissing meritless lawsuits that have no basis in fact or law, but are just a political strategy to overturn an election. And so I'm very worried about the lack of real consequences and accountability that we've yet to see for all of these really unprecedented efforts to block the will of the people that we survived in 2020. And I think we have to be prepared to know we may not survive it again if there are no consequences and if there are no protections put in place to ensure these attempts, once they come back, are able to be blocked again.
Yeah, I don't know if either of you have seen the news this morning. Politico has the text of an executive order from Trump in the White House that was never implemented, but that was the order to seize the voting machines, to mobilize the military to do that. It's the quiet part that's been speculated is now revealed in black and white and on their website. Thank God that that wasn't sent, or that it was intercepted. However, it turns out it didn't come to fruition. But the folks that talk about a potential constitutional crisis in the future are really whistling past the graveyard of the very clear and grave one that we were able to avoid last November, December, and January.
Yeah, I think I've said kind of consistently since January 6th that up until then, I mean, this was a daily occurrence, that whether they were the personal threats that myself and other election officials endured and continue to endure, whether they were the meritless lawsuits, the sham legislative hearings, the bizarre press conferences that we witnessed all in that sort of fall of 2020 time period, all of which were designed to not just sow seeds of doubt and create illegitimacy around our democracy, but to block the results of a presidential election. All of that we thought was a moment that we would overcome. And if we could just, get to preserving the results of that election and get past that, we'd be able to move forward and make democracy continue to be robust for everyone. after January 6th, I realized that all of this was just the beginning of a multi-year coordinated national strategy that has really only escalated and, I would argue, increased in sophistication since then. And shame on us and every pro-democracy person out there if we are not doing everything we can right now in this moment to be prepared to block future attempts to undo democracy that, again, the plans for which are being revealed and unveiled before our very eyes.
In Michigan specifically, what are you looking toward in terms of the 2022 elections? What are some of the election administration challenges that you foresee, and how are you going to handle them?
Well, I think first and foremost, what I've always believed and what has become even more clear since I've been the Secretary of State of Michigan and the Chief Election Officer is that democracy prevails because people demand that it does. It prevailed in 2020, not just because so many people voted, but because good people on both sides of the aisle, in places of authority, from secretaries of state to county canvassing boards to state canvassing boards, they did the right thing. They followed the legal responsibility they had to protect democracy. A lot of those people, as you all know, are in the process of being replaced or have since been replaced. And, you know, as I, you know, embark on this election cycle for my own office, we see the same, you know, threat emerging where you see on one side, you have people who are committed to defending democracy and on the other side, people trying to replace us with those who will willingly allow the subversion of an election because they don't agree with the results. So all that said, I think that the biggest challenge in 22 is making sure citizens know that they will have a very clear choice this fall, not just at the statewide level, but at the local level as well, and in every race that is on the ballot, as to whether or not they will support those who defend democracy and reject those who are trying to dismantle it in the, you know, light of day. Or whether they will, you know, allow for individuals who very clearly have a political agenda of dismantling democracy to ascend into even greater positions of authority and be in a position to make real these election subversion efforts in the future. So I think that one of the biggest challenges is just that, making sure voters know this real choice. And then on the election administration side, protecting the current system against people who have already been put in place to potentially undo the will of the people if they don't like the results. One of the ways in which that has already been covered is the county canvassing appointees and the state canvassing board appointees, the money who protected democracy in 2020 have since been replaced with those who have a questionable allegiance to the law and democracy principles. And then, you know, secondly, the election administrators, poll workers, election workers who also held the line in 2020 and made sure all the safety protocols were followed, that every valid vote was counted. You know, there are efforts underway to replace them and recruit poll workers who may not have that same commitment to protecting democracy and following the law. And so we have to be mindful of the potential for election administration malfeasance as we administer elections at the state and local level in 22.
Jocelyn, I think you did a great job. And I call you Jocelyn because you're our longtime friend, so no disrespect intended. I think you did a fabulous job on many things in 2020, but the absentee voting, you know, no reason absentee voting, which was brought to us by Proposal 3 and 218, you did a lot to implement that, to facilitate it, make it accessible. We had record numbers of absentee voters as a result. What specifics are you working on for 2022 to build on that and hope to even increase perhaps the amount of absentee voting in the state?
Well, yes. I mean, voters were very clear. They gave me a mandate when I was elected. They amended our state constitution to give themselves a right to be able to vote from home, vote absentee. So my job was to make that right real and to also make sure everyone knew how to access that right. And so we sent every registered voter a request form so that they knew, regardless of where they lived or who they were going to vote for, they had equal access to that information on how to vote absentee. The reason why that was so important in 2020 to do was because it was the first statewide election cycle in which that right was in place. And so we needed to initially educate those citizens and also, of course, in the midst of a pandemic, know that many people would be wanting to vote from home. And we wanted to make that an easy option for them to take advantage of. And so a lot of our work on the front end was just making sure people knew. And then secondly, making sure our election administrators were prepared, particularly in November, to receive three times the number of absentee ballot requests that they had ever received before. The remarkable thing, and this doesn't get talked about a lot, is that in the August primary, and I'm sure you guys probably saw this, but I was amazed. We had 2.5 million people voted overall in the August primary, and about half of those, or 1.5 million, were voting absentee. And so those numbers were already breaking records, and we were working with our election administrators to make sure they could mail out, because it takes time to process those request forms, mail them out, get them back in time. We then had the postal service problems that we had to counter by installing drop boxes all across the state, which we foresaw and started putting in place in the spring and in the early summer months of 2020. Our focus was really just building an infrastructure to enable citizens to exercise their right to vote absentee in Michigan, and then educate them on how to do so. Now that we're past that for 22, we have so many citizens, 3.3 million of the 5.5 million who voted in November voted absentee. So a lot of people are already familiar with the process, and our education lift is much lighter. However, if the legislature or others change the process, then we have to reexamine how to educate people about those changes. But right now, I'm confident that the majority of voters in our state know their options to vote, know how to exercise them, and we'll continue to support and work with our clerks to make sure they have what they need to receive and turn around those ballots, that the ballot tracking mechanisms are in place and all those other details continue to be in place. So it's a long-winded way of saying we did it really well in 20. Ultimately, we succeeded in educating and our voters on how to vote absentee and ensuring our system could withstand that influx. Now we just want to repeat that success in 2022 and shield it from these efforts to try to make it harder for us to administer this absentee voting process, which is really what a lot of these reforms you hear about being proposed by the Republicans in this legislature are really aimed at trying to do.
What I fear looking ahead to 2022 and 2024 are Republican efforts, not just to diminish the volume of vote by mail, of absentee votes, of what they consider likely Democratic voters ease from participating in the election. But what I fear are the extremes, the radicals in people who have become even more radicalized since the November 2020 election, from trying to interfere with effectively the chain of custody with ballots in places like Detroit or Flint or Saginaw, trying to do before the election what they somewhat attempted to do after the election at places like the TCF Center. We not only have to consider now in elections and administering elections, just the process of making sure all the votes are counted, but making sure there's adequate security, hardening these clerk's offices and ballot locations, something we never had to consider before, violence on election day or leading up to or after the election in places that are counting. It's just a this awful new reality that we're faced with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is a reality that is born out of a political strategy that is ultimately designed, I believe, to cause people to give up on democracy and to cause it to be such a difficult thing to stay engaged with and to defend that they ultimately let go of the responsibility we all have as citizens to protect and make real the democracy for everyone. And I think particularly considering the increasing diversity in our country, in our state, and the diversification of the electorate, we see, unfolding a long-term and short-term political strategy to basically deter people from not just voting and being engaged, but holding their elected officials accountable, particularly when they promote policies that don't reflect what the majority of people really want. And so I think it's important for everyone to kind of see that why this is happening, that it's not just about a former presidential candidate who has kind of, you know, personified a lot of this and really just taken it to another level in terms of a strategy to maintain power in our country. But it's, you know, it's a much more complex, multifaceted effort that even foreign governments have an interest in fomenting and helping succeed. And that's why you've seen that level of, you know, foreign interference and particularly threats of election officials and other things still present as well. And that's why it's not hyperbole to say this is a war over the future of our democracy that we're engaged in. And I would just emphasize, as I always try to do, that it's a war we can unequivocally win and ensure our democracy prevails, but only if citizens stay engaged, get engaged, and you know, defend their right to vote in every state in this country.
Well, with that, I think we do need to wrap up. Just with a personal anecdote, Johnson, I know how disappointed we were when you didn't win in 210. But I think in the grand scheme of things, you are the right person in the right place at the right time, having won that important office in 218. And really appreciate everything you've done to defend democracy, service improvements, everything that you have brought to that office. It's just been extraordinary.
Thank you.
Well, I would add to that. I at the time, back in 2010, had a much different view, and I knew and worked very closely with Ruth Johnson, and I know her quite well. And I thank God every day that she's not in the office right now.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, all this, I feel very blessed to be serving in this moment. But it's also, you know, a time when everyone who cares about democracy has to step up and find ways to serve, as you know. And as I think, Mark, you know, in particular, this has been my life's work. And this isn't, I didn't seek this position because I wanted to be or hold political office. I wanted to protect everyone's right to vote. And so it's an honor to be able to do so from this position at this time, because as you know, this is a moment where the attacks on the right to vote are particularly pernicious and in need of all of us really putting our best feet forward to defend against.
Great. Thanks so much and good luck in the important work that you're doing for all of us, Jocelyn.
Onward we go. Thank you for all your work as well.
And that's a wrap for this week's podcast. Our thanks to Jocelyn Benson, Michigan Secretary of State, for joining us this week.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, send us an email, comments@therepublicpodcast.com.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. See you next week.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.